The Hard Shoulder on Newstalk.
With the all-new Nissan Juke. The coupe crossover by Nissan. Nissan. Innovation that excites.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be joined for this Thursday's Thursday interview by Irish author who has brought joy to many millions of children, young adults and older readers over the past number of decades. He sold more than 250 million books worldwide with his name on the cover. And that's before you talk about movie deals, graphic novels and lots more to come. But most importantly of all, Owen Colfer hails from Wexford and therefore is a fellow Yellow Belly for whom Wexford people are very proud. You're most welcome, Owen. But I mean, like, you know, I get all this Wexford stuff, but now you're living in Monkstown.
I am. I do feel...
When did you desert?
I deserted about 4 years ago when I was doing the Laureate and I was in Dublin in the office 3 days a week and it just became a little much. So I moved up to Monkstown temporarily at first, but now my young fellow
Jackie and your two sons are settled in Dublin now.
Yeah, well, Finn is in London and Sean is in school in Monkstown, so or in Booterstown. So yeah, we're going to stay till Sean's finished school anyway.
But do you still have the place in Wexford?
Oh yeah,
like, do you have a home to go?
Yeah,
to?
We have. We're down there every week.
Oh, lovely.
I stay. Jackie stays two nights at least with her mom.
All right. You're kind of half and half.
We are half and half because.
All right. So I thought you were a complete deserter.
Oh no.
Well, you're certainly busy, but I want to go to the Wexford bit of it first because, like, your creativity is quite extraordinary. Like, we're going to talk about your new adult fantasy movie, and High Fire, I think it's called. And I just can't get my head around what's happening in New Orleans with that. And the whole Artemis Fowl and the Fowl Twins and all of that, it comes from a kind of special place insofar as it's not normal. It's not like people look at ESRI reports, they look at the, you know, all kind of worldly things that they deal with, newspapers and media. Yeah. And, you know, on your smartphone, that is normal. Where did it come from?
Well, I think the secret is that I thought it was normal. When I was growing up, even before I went to school, my dad, you knew my dad, he had, he was very creative as a painter, also as a set builder for theatres and a writer. And my mum was a writer. So we were writing stories at home and I thought, yeah, this is what happens. This is the way it goes. And when I go to school, everybody will be bringing their stories in. And that's going to be great and we can swap books. And I got to school and I found out that no, that wasn't happening. And in fact, everyone was playing soccer and everybody was doing other things. And there was maybe two guys who were, I would feel, kindred spirits. But it was too late by then. My road was set, the needle was in the groove and I was off telling stories. So it was too late for me to change. And so it's always seemed normal to me, and I seek out other people who are like the same way inclined. So, you know, I hang out with people like PJ Lynch, for example, and to us, that's life. That's what we do.
Yeah,
it's very normal. So yeah, I'm.
But the walking tours your dad did.
Yeah.
Which sort of delved into the layers of history, because Wexford has a strong tradition of waves of Vikings and Normans and all the different folk that came to the nice beach at Curraghclough and the nice port at Wexford. I mean, that sparked your curiosity, those walking tours, didn't it?
Absolutely. Dad was one of the first teachers in the country to introduce local history to the syllabus, which he did himself. That wasn't in any book. So he wrote the book about local history and he taught us about the kids in his classroom about the history of where we had come from, Wexford. He taught us that beneath the main street we were walking on, there was a Viking street. We had never heard anything like that before. And I think the crowning glory that I remember was that in one Patrick's Day parade in 1976, we built a Viking longship and put it on the back of a lorry. And
like a milk float.
Like
thing.
A milk float.
An industrial one.
And all the kids dressed up as Vikings. Now, in
this
the 70s,
was before Game of Thrones,
this
right?
This was it was the original. there was no nudity, but you know, no violence. But and at the time, that was kind of amazing for that to happen? I mean,
I'm it's not that I'm a mathematical person, yeah. but I try and have logic in yeah. my mind, and I read so much stuff that is yeah. imparting information, and it's money and it's facts and it's yeah. figures and it's perspectives and it's points of view. Like, I just couldn't imagine yeah. sitting down to a blank page and talking or writing about fairies.
And
just
thinking,
explain
yeah.
that to people who are odd like me.
Yeah. Well, you see, you're in, I suppose in world terms, you're not odd. You are the usual normal person who doesn't think in terms of fantasy and magic.
Is it a genetic thing, do you think?
I think definitely in our family it is, because my brother Eamon is a playwright and my other brother Niall is an archaeologist, so he goes down to those streets.
And tell us about your mum.
My mother is a dramatist, an actress, at one time All-Ireland Best Actress Amateur, we're very proud of that. She had a show, a radio show with her friends for a while back in the 80s. RT2 FM came to Wexford to do outside broadcasts. My mum had a show with Breida Tobin, I think. They've written poetry books. So she's very accomplished. And I learned to write, and this is possibly the best way ever to learn to write. I learned to write doing my mother's lines, or to read, I should say, when I was 4. She would be in Riders to the Sea playing Peggy and Mike or something, and then I would do all the other parts. So, I mean, for me...
At 4?
Yeah, that's how I learned to read. And that was my kind of...
And would you do accents and
oh,
all?
Oh, I'd do my best. Yeah, I thought I was amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
As it turns out, I wasn't, but...
You were Othello and you were yeah. Hamlet and you were...
But that, for me, that was my Seamus Heaney moment.
Right.
With my mother peeling potatoes, but we were doing lines.
So if I was to pick up... go to the horse breeding sales and to pick up the pedigree. The dam was a drama queen and the dad was a historical stroke yeah. teacher stroke writer as well.
He was very much a Renaissance man and he kind of parcelled out one talent to each of his sons that he had. So we all...
Do you think we're all, on a philosophical level, do you think we're the product of our parents, really, in yeah. terms of both nature and nurture?
I don't think 100%, and I say that because I have two sons who are complete opposites. And they both, as far as I can see, had pretty similar upbringings. But definitely, I mean, they were definitely born with some of their personality intact. But that could be a genetic thing where you're inheriting that personality, so then it would be nature.
Okay. So we're going to find out after the news and a break how this regular teacher, with a difficult upbringing, we'll have to say, and an extraordinary pedigree, came to be a renowned author. Stay with me. Let's get a news update now from Eamon. Welcome back. If you missed our earlier discussion with Owen Colfer, he is my Thursday interview guest. He is a primary school teacher, but he's famous for Artemis Fowl, the Fowl Twins, Benny and Omar, and he has lots of new projects in gestation, including in January, High Fire, which is an adult fantasy novel, a new direction. And in May of next year, the much-acclaimed Artemis Fowl movie is to come out. So plenty to discuss. So far, we've gone through his childhood, his early influences and so on. So the point I was building to was, how does a regular teacher turn their hobby, their passion, their life soul interest into a career?
That is the kind of lottery winning dream that you don't think is going to happen. So your hope would be, or my hope was, to teach during the year, which I did enjoy doing, and then in the summer every year write a book for children and hopefully...
On your holidays?
Yeah, on my holidays.
How many thousand words would that be?
That would be like, for a novel, maybe 70,000 for young people. And I thought, if I do 1,000 words a day for 2 months, I'm nearly there. And that's what I did for a few years. But there was no hope that I would ever be able to leave teaching and be a full-time writer. There just wasn't...
What era was this now? The 90s?
This would have been the early 90s, yep.
Yeah.
So I had a series of books published, Benny and Omar, Benny and Babe, The Wish List, 3 picture books. And they all did great. You know, they were all number ones in Ireland. But it wasn't until Artemis Fowl came along and I got an agent that things really changed.
So did you find the stipend, the royalties yeah. that you got from an Irish bestseller, like you couldn't live on it?
No, you couldn't.
What sort of money? Like, would you get a massive check for 400 quid or something like that?
And it was actually, you're spot on.
That Benny was, and Omar. Yeah.
Benny and Omar, the advance I got for that was £200.
Jeez.
And that was the Christmas number one in Ireland, and the total earnings were, I think, £1,200. So I thought I was going to be, you know, we were going to be flying to Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
And then the check came in. I went,
you couldn't even fix the roof for that.
No. I think I had a visa bill that I paid off a little bit. So, but that's fine. I mean, I was really happy to have a book with my name on it.
And it was quite affirming to have a bestseller in a category that was not easy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The other thing was, it's not like you were writing chick lit or something that was equivalent to something else.
No.
It was unique material.
Well, I think the Benny and Omar book especially, it was unusual in that there was an Irish boy living in North Africa. So you had the familiar and the exotic. And then the Irish boy was trying to play hurling in South Africa. So even though it was very popular in Ireland, overseas people didn't really get what I was talking about.
You spent time in Tunisia, didn't you?
Yeah, I was working there at the time and I was very, very struck.
Teaching?
I was teaching, yeah. My wife was teaching Jackie and I was very struck by how orphans in some parts of Tunisia, there's no help for them. So if you're an orphan, well, you're just an orphan on the street. That's the end of it. So that was the focus of the book, how this Irish guy goes out there and has this realization that everywhere is not as nice as Wexford.
And what sort of quantum did Benny and Omar sell? Like, would it sell 30,000?
No. I mean, it has now because it's kind of gone into schools now. It's become part of curriculum, especially with the new emphasis on migration to this country.
Yeah.
So, but at the time, I think it might have sold 1,000 copies.
Oh, right. It was very much in the hobby category.
Yeah.
So you wrote Artemis Fowl.
Yeah.
It was on sale in Ireland and you were listening to The Late Late Show and someone said, who is an author, you really need an agent to make it in this game.
Yeah.
And Jackie saw this, did she?
And said,
what you need is an agent.
Well, I had done all these books and I had Artemis written and it wasn't published. And I think it was John Connolly or Darren Chan who were on The Late Late Show and they said that things changed around for them when they got an agent. And Jackie saw this and she said, right, you need to get an agent. And I sent it in to a London agent and it was signed up straight away. And
well, that's an interesting story. So this guy from Wexford rings up and says, I've got this book. Is that it?
I did ring up actually because... whoever was on the late
Gronje.
And this girl, she was at the time, she was the assistant to the agent, and now she's a big time agent herself in New York. But she answered Gronje Fox in an Irish accent. She's a Dublin girl. And I went like, oh, but Jesus, Bigara, I am also Irish.
Right.
And she said, so we had a nice chat and she said, listen, send me the book and I will give it to Sophie, who is now my agent. She takes one book on holidays and I'll give her this one if it's any good.
And this was in circulation in Ireland?
No, I hadn't let it out to anybody.
Oh, I see. Oh, I told you. So Benny and Omar had been through O'Brien Press in Ireland, but this hadn't hit the streets yet.
I was holding this one back because I was going to try and get an agent this time.
But were you really looking at moving to the international market? Did you realise there was a limitation?
Well, I felt that we were both working. We had a new baby. Something had to give because I couldn't now do the 2 hours, 3 hours a day after work writing. So because I was looking after the baby. So the writing was going to have to go unless I could make it a profession.
Sure.
So I needed to do it or that would kind of be the end of it for 5 years.
So tell me about Sophie.
Sophie is
she's someone I need to know. Yes,
Sophie is
Sophie Hicks.
Sophie Hicks is
can monetize things, can she?
That's what she does, and you don't have to. You see, now we're talking. You don't
have diesel now.
You don't have to be the bad guy because Sophie is the most charming bad guy you'd ever meet, and she just gets you what she feels you're worth, and she's been doing that. We're together 20 years now.
So just tell us about because this is your big breakthrough, really.
Yeah.
Just tell us about, you know, the kind of phone calls you got, or did you have to go? Did she say, look, I'm going to send the manuscript to three things, and you're going to be interviewed? Or what was the process?
The process, if you're living in Wexford and you've read about these things, it was kind of unbelievable. First of all, she came over to see me. We had dinner in some...
She'd read it on holidays.
She'd read on holidays. She came straight back from holidays and then the next day she came over to see me. I signed the paper straight away.
You didn't play hard to get.
No, because it's not like you haggle.
Yeah.
There's percentages and that's it.
Okay.
So...
Although you might find in future you might haggle a little.
Yeah, you see, she haggles for me. Yeah. No, I don't mean you don't haggle with an agent because
they go on and haggle on your behalf.
They say, right, I get a 15% cut of whatever I get.
Okay.
Or 10%, I can't remember. And so she said, I'm going to go about this in an unusual way because I think this is very cinematic. So she went first to Disney with the manuscript, and they bought it. And then once
Before it went to a publisher.
And once that happened,
and
then,
they didn't care about the book rights, did
oh,
they?
No, they did, but they knew that if you have a movie deal, then the publishers will really want the book.
What year was that?
This was 2000, 2001. So late 2000.
And that movie still hasn't seen the light of day.
No. And that's not 20 bad.
20-year gestation. Like
Douglas Adams, had died before his movie came out.
Do you mind
Narnia
asking
books.
A personal question?
Yeah.
Did Disney pay you 20 years ago for the film that's coming out in next May?
Yeah, they did. They did. And like that payment was what allowed me to stop working and to concentrate on writing.
That must have surprised you. That, like, here you are as an author,
yeah,
and you've got the movie deal before you've got the book deal.
It's very surprising. I think the first book deal was Penguin in the UK, and that came through about the same time. But definitely the movie deal sold it around the world. So, yeah, that was a great tactic, and that set me up for the rest of my life.
Was it primarily the UK market or the US market for the book? Because Disney would be transatlantic.
Disney took it in the US, and that's still my biggest market.
Is it?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
so, and Penguin covered the UK and the US?
Penguin are doing the UK, Canada, Australia.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that hit the streets in what year then?
It came out in the summer of 2001.
Okay.
And it was.
Did you have to do a big book tour? Like for a Wexford fella, did you have to dress up properly and go around in smart clothes?
I had to buy smart clothes, Ivan. Everything I had was like school teacher corduroy.
Yeah.
So I was big into the cords.
Did you do lectures or interviews?
You did everything. And I mean, I think
it must have been a bit of a learning curve in the beginning.
It was very steep. And one time I was brought on to Good Morning America, and I didn't really, no one could understand while I was there. And there was a setup because they were doing a thing on violence in kids' books, and they decided to scapegoat me.
Right.
But being a smart talking Wexford guy who grew up with George Lawler, I was well able for that.
Right.
And so the interviewer it was Diane Sawyer. She kind of backed off because I was being quite glib back. And the next day the book was number 3. So it was
It's a big break.
It was a huge break. And it wasn't supposed to be a break. It was supposed to be my kind of death knell. But she picked on the wrong guy.
And sticking with Artemis Fowl then, and has just been onward and upward ever since, or has there been any rock in the road? Has there been anything that hasn't taken off
Wanted? I've done a lot of books that, I mean, and they've done okay. And some books have done brilliantly. So a lot of my books haven't, set the world on fire, but since then, no, everything's been very, very respectable. And
okay,
yeah.
So the movie was actually made.
Yeah.
Kenneth Branagh
directed.
And Connor McPherson. Tell me about all that.
Well, I had kind of consigned the movie to the scrap heap in my mind because it had nearly been there many
Jim
times.
Jim Sheridan was involved.
Jim was doing it. I was doing it. I was doing it with Jim. We actually wrote with his daughter, Naomi. We wrote a version.
This all for Disney?
At that point, the man in charge was Harvey Weinstein.
Right.
So he was the guy pulling the strings. I never dealt with him or talked to him. But he just lost interest after a while. And we thought we were still working on it.
What was a big budget? What was the obstacle?
I think the obstacle for them was trying to make a kids movie about a bad guy who's a hero. And they just could not break that. That was a hump they couldn't get over. And I was trying to tell them it's like a Robin Hood character. He starts off thinking he's bad, but that's that kind of degree of character development. It was tough for them to break. And it wasn't until Kenneth Branagh came on board. And of course, as a Shakespeare man, he could see where you can have ambiguity in a character. That wasn't a problem for him.
And then the movie was made. It was due to be out this year, and it didn't. Why was that?
It just wasn't finished. They had a lot of special effects to do, and it was taking a little bit longer than they thought. So when Memorial Day weekend came up, that's what they call the Pirates weekend, the Pirates of the Caribbean. But there wasn't going to be a Pirates, so Disney said, well, why don't you take this? It's our biggest weekend. And so I was disappointed at first, but now I think it's going to be really good for the movie. It'll be 100% ready. And
we'll be here in Ireland?
It'll be all over the world on the 29th of May. So it's going to be a worldwide Disney
so
release.
Artemis was up and running, and then you weren't happy with that, but the 11-year-old had to have two twins. Two twin brother, Miles and Beckett.
Miles and Beckett.
So here we go again.
Here we go again. Not for as long, though. I think I couldn't launch into an Apex.
Fowler twins.
Just the three. I'm going to be three Fowler twin books, and then I think that will be it for them. I'm quite enjoying it. It was too much at the time to go back into that world, so I left it for about 6-7 years, and now I feel excited about it again.
So where are we at now?
Well, at the moment, the two boys, Miles and Beckett, are living on Dalkey Island. Somehow they managed to get planning permission out there, and that's where their little eco house is, and they're just getting involved in fairy-related shenanigans. So it's more of a straightforward
comedy.
So that's
book number one.
Right.
And is that quite Irish-centric?
Can you get
it to the American market?
Oh, it's already there. I think the American market loves Irish-centric stuff.
Okay.
So,
and is that modelled on your own sons, Sean and Finn?
It is kind of modelled on Finn and Sean, but I've exploded their personalities a lot, so they're quite exaggerated versions of Finn and Sean. So the boys are, they're tolerating it at the moment.
So give us your insights into parenting.
I don't think anyone has an insight into parenting. We just tried to be supportive and positive and do what my parents did, which is we make art and sport available to them whenever they want it. I mean, I'm a big believer in sports.
So why didn't you send them into accountancy and insurance and get a proper job?
I feel I can actually facilitate them having an artistic life if they want one.
One is in fashion, is that one, right?
Finn is at the moment working with the Sunday Times weekend magazine in London in fashion. He's a stylist. He had his first photo shoot out there last week, so we're very proud of him. And Sean is in transition year, and he wants to be a sports journalist.
Right.
So he is. He's going to do a few internships. We managed to get him into.
It's a tough new environment for all that. You know what I mean? Because just the way the whole internet has gone and blogging and so on. It's a tough,
I know
tough
everyone
and the traditional media are really suffering.
I know because everyone, and it's the same as writing, because everyone can say, "Well, I'm a blogger. I'm a sports journalist. I'm a writer." So it is a tough one to get into.
Okay. Now. Let's move on to the bit that I've read it twice and I still can't make head nor tail of it. A humanoid dragon.
Yes.
In the Honey Island Swamp Monster of Louisiana.
Yeah.
It's a forthcoming book and presumably TV series, and it's an adult fantasy called High Fire. I'm losing the will to live here.
I know,
explain
but
it to me.
Yeah, it hopefully the will to live will return to you in a burst. It's kind of based on the idea.
Is it CGI kind of high tech or what?
Well,
what does he look like? Does he look like a human or a monster or what?
In the book, he looks like you imagine him to look. So he's like a 7-foot-tall dragon. In the TV series which MGM are doing, I don't think they're that far into it yet. I would imagine it will be a man in a suit. I don't think it will be a CGI character.
Oh, I see. So. Tell me about the book then, how this came about. Because it is a change of genre to adult fantasy.
Yeah, it kind of is. I mean, I did...
Like it's bold, isn't it?
It is, yeah. You do worry about that when you skip genre, especially when you're known as a kids writer. If you're an adult writer, it's not so much a big deal. And even though I've done 4 or 5 adult books, people still see me as a kids writer, which is great because I love to be one. But every now and then you take a break. So this is about this dragon. He's the last dragon. And I just thought it would be funny that if you subvert the idea of the noble dragon, that you make him kind of a waster, he's a bit of a Homer Simpson kind of dragon, and he's just hiding out with the alligators in this swamp. And then he gets inadvertently dragged into this drug pipeline, which is going through the swamp, and it becomes this big comic adventure. And I thought it would be a little aside I would do, but then again, Sophie, got on the phone and we had a TV deal, and then we have I'm going with Joe Fletcher Books over here and HarperCollins in the US, so we're having a very big launch in January, so it's going better than I could have hoped.
And you know the way you could trace Benny and Omar to your Tunisia time, you could the Fowler twins to your own kids. Where did this come out of?
This came out of actually a very different experience where a friend of mine, a co-author, Andrew Duncan, went to Loch Ness. And I said, why are you going to Loch Ness? And he said, well, we're going to look for the Loch Ness Monster? And I said, well, you know, there isn't a Loch Ness Monster. Yeah. He said, no, I don't, and neither do you. And I said, well, imagine if there was a Loch Ness Monster, how fed up he would be to have you goons coming up trying to find him. So I started to tell that story from the point of the Loch Ness Monster, but then I felt it didn't quite sit right there, so I moved it to Louisiana, where they have their version of a Loch Ness Monster called the Honey Island Monster, which there are books dedicated to. And this
it has some basis in fact.
Well, here's the basis, Ivan, and you tell me is this fact. The explanation in the book is that in 1940 or 50, a circus train crashed into the swamp. And this actually happened.
Something escaped.
But not only that, but a gorilla escaped and then had communion with an alligator.
I was just going to say, mated with something.
Mated with an alligator.
Ah,
I mean,
Lord.
So imagine if
Owen Colfer. No, no, this is what,
I'm not trying to sell that, you see. I thought that was hilarious, that this is an industry. An actual living industry now.
Well, New Orleans with Mardi Gras is full of that kind of colour. And
so I thought if you were a dragon, how fed up would you be that this was your backstory? That this is what people thought. And so this dragon is living there and he's very upset by the fact that people think that his dad was a gorilla, his mum was an alligator.
Okay, in the couple of minutes left, I ask all my guests some of these questions. First of all, what are your future plans? Is there any unfulfilled ambitions?
Yeah, I would really love to do a musical, some musical theatre. I've done some with my composer friend Liam Bates, and we would like to do a big one. And we're
do
in
you
talks.
Play instruments yourself?
No, I just do the lyrics. Liam is
But you can write music? No,
I just do lyrics only. Okay. And Liam does all the music and I do the book. And
so you do a full-blown musical?
We've done a couple.
Yes.
We want to do one. We're hoping to do one next year. And we're in talks to secure some songs at the moment. So that's what I would really like to do.
Okay. Again, a bit of a pivot.
You have to keep yourself interested, Ivan. If you're lucky enough to make a living at it, then your second thing is you have to stay excited by it. And
all right,
like the Fowl family makes the few bob for me, and then I can, in between those books, do something I really love.
Okay, you were born in 1965. That makes you circa mid-50s.
Yeah.
What would you advise your 18-year-old self? Well, having made the mistakes and having the ups and downs, what would you advise?
I would advise me not to take my 20s off, because I kind of did that. I mean, writing-wise, I was in teaching. I love teaching, and I just kind of enjoyed those 10 years, and I feel I could have maybe written some good work in that time, which I didn't really try to do.
But it wasn't as if you were immature on a gap year. You were actually kind of...
Yeah.
So the moral of the story is?
Well... My dad always said,
"Do what you want to do."
Yeah, do a little bit of what you want to do. My dad always said, "You can't get that time back. So if you don't do that now, you can't make up the time. You could have done more. So do it while you can." I really admire people, and I know it's tough, that decide in their 20s, you know what, I want to be an actor. I'm going to give it 2 years, and do that.
And in terms of flippant final sort of question, what's life all about insofar as you will have a legacy of all this artistic work?
Yeah.
Is that enough for you? I mean, like, in terms of, you have your family as well. Are you religious or spiritual?
I would say I'm spiritual, but I'm not. I know it's an old cop-out answer. I'm not very religious, no.
But do you believe in a higher power?
I do believe in some higher power, and I don't. I know people claim to know what that is, but it's supposed to be ineffable and mysterious, and that's how it is for me. So,
what's the best bit of advice you ever got?
The best bit of advice.
Surely Sophie had something good to say.
Well, Sophie's good thing is that you say nothing. You don't say anything.
Yes. And that's a good negotiation
technique. That's a great
because
one.
Because someone else will fill the
silence. Yeah, just say nothing.
Yeah.
And,
I heard
a great thing about Neil Jordan, a story about him where he was. I go into these meetings with studios. And they say, well, could it be more like this? Could it be more like that? And instead of trying to fill people's desires, Neil just says, no, that's not what we're looking for. And that gives him all the power in a situation. And I think that is fantastic, to stand up for what you want and say, no, you know what? That's not what I want to do. And make other people think rather than you.
Well, I greatly look forward to talking to you again, because just you are a conveyor belt, a volcano of creativity. And my thanks for sharing your experiences, your expertise and your thoughts, and certainly for any budding or wannabe creative person in the arts, in literature, in whatever I think you are an inspiration. Owen Colfer, thank you for being my Thursday interview guest.
Thank you, Ivan. My pleasure.
And that's it from us on the show this evening. My thanks to the entire team for today's show. Dan Flanagan, Alex Russo, Roisin Davis and John O'Donovan. Off the Ball is up next. Yes, and I'll be on Premier Sports from 7:45 on. We're going to the Emirates, Arsenal versus Brighton. But I will be back here tomorrow. Join me at 4. Until then, have a great night and thanks for listening.